Picture this, if you will. A 52-year-old, otherwise healthy male presents to the emergency department for 24 hours of nausea and vomiting after partaking of a warm seafood buffet 2 days ago aboard a Hootenanny cruise ship. Guess that's the last time he'll make that mistake. But his labs come back normal, and based on his clinical presentation, you explain to the patient that he most likely has viral gastroenteritis. You explain that the plan is to try to control his nausea sufficiently enough to allow him to take at least fluids by mouth. But his daughter asks anxiously, isn't he going to get hypoglycemic if he can't eat? He's already thrown up everything in the last 24 hours. Based on what you know about the body's glucose metabolism, you consider your response. And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from biochemistry from our bricks to your ears. Today we'll be covering gluconeogenesis, or how the body ensures consistent serum levels of glucose, the most valuable metabolic fuel. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. List the compounds that can and cannot serve as glucose precursors in gluconeogenesis. 2. Describe the metabolic pathway of gluconeogenesis. And 3. Describe ways in which gluconeogenesis and glycolysis are reciprocally regulated. Part 1. What is gluconeogenesis? When the body's in a position to absorb and catabolize nutrients from the GI tract, otherwise known as the fed state, glucose is used by almost all the cells in the body to generate energy. But even when we're not fueling it with food, most cells in the body still function optimally by using glucose as the major metabolic fuel. And for this, the body needs a way to keep serum glucose levels stable, even in the fasting state. In order to accomplish this, the human body has to perform gluconeogenesis, the process of synthesizing glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. The major substrates the body can convert to glucose are lactate, glycerol, propionate, and a handful of amino acids known collectively as the glucogenic amino acids. And most of you probably know this. What organ is responsible for performing the majority of gluconeogenesis? The liver is the first organ everyone thinks of, which is correct. But remember that the kidneys are also a major source of gluconeogenesis and may contribute up to 40% of the total glucose in the fasting state, and even more in starvation. After an overnight fast, glucose levels are kept stable by roughly equal contributions from gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis, or the breakdown of stored glucose polysaccharides. But the human body only has about 24 hours worth of glycogen reserves available at maximum capacity. And once those are depleted, gluconeogenesis becomes progressively more important. Failure of gluconeogenesis can be fatal. Remember that the brain runs on glucose almost exclusively, and critical hypoglycemia can lead to seizures, coma, and even death. In addition, gluconeogenesis clears the serum lactate produced by muscle and erythrocytes, and the glycerol produced by adipose tissue. The maintenance of a stable blood glucose is one of the most finely regulated of all homeostatic mechanisms. Insulin, secreted in response to increased blood glucose, enhances synthesis of the key enzymes in glycolysis, while glucocorticoids and glucagon induce synthesis of key enzymes in gluconeogenesis. All right, guys, time for a quick knowledge check. What are the major substrates used for gluconeogenesis? The major substrates are lactate, glycerol, propionate, and the glucogenic amino acids. Part 2. How are gluconeogenesis and glycolysis related? Because glycolysis is such a central process in human metabolism, gluconeogenesis is generally taught as roughly the reverse of glycolysis. So we're going to run through a quick review of the critical steps in glycolysis before we tackle gluconeogenesis. First, what is the end product of glycolysis? Each glucose molecule is broken down into two pyruvate molecules. All right, that was an easy one. Here's a tougher one. How much ATP does it cost to enter the glycolysis pathway? And how much ATP do you get back by the end? So, glycolysis can be roughly divided into two pathways. An investment phase, where you have to spend 2 ATP to enter the metabolic pathway, and a payoff phase, where you gain 4 ATP and high energy electron carrier, NADH. And as you might imagine, the enzymes that either expend or generate ATP are the most tightly regulated, since ATP ain't free. Hint, those enzymes all end in kinase. In the investment phase, glucose is broken down into two 3-carbon sugars, During the first step, hexokinase uses one ATP. And during the third step, phosphofructokinase, or PFK, uses another ATP. The end result is to add two phosphate molecules to the 6-carbon sugar before it's cleaved into two 3-carbon sugars called G3P, or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. During the payoff phase, each G3P molecule gets metabolized by phosphoglycerate kinase and pyruvate kinase, which each generates 2 ATP for a total of 4 ATP per glucose molecule, and the end product is 2 pyruvate molecules. Put a pin in that bit of knowledge and save it for later, because you're going to need it. Now, if you want to know every single step in glycolysis, you should check out the brick specifically covering it. But I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Enzymes, as biologic catalysts, increase the rate of both the forward and the reverse reaction. As a result, you can use the majority of glycolysis enzymes in gluconeogenesis as well. Pretty neat, huh? But things get a little tricky when it comes to the kinase steps. By definition, since these reactions involve ATP, they either require or release substantial energy. With glycolysis, which is a catabolic reaction, the primary concern is the energy output of the reaction. But with gluconeogenesis, which is an anabolic reaction, the primary concern is to generate the end product, which is glucose. And if you're not as concerned about energy efficiency, you can perform some of these reverse reactions more easily if you simply sacrifice the energy payoff. So even though the majority of gluconeogenesis is performed by exactly the same enzymes as glycolysis, 3 out of the 4 kinase steps in glycolysis are replaced with bypass reactions that we're going to go over in more detail. The first step in gluconeogenesis is the conversion of pyruvate to phosphoenol pyruvate, or PEP. Basically, it's the reversal of the pyruvate kinase step of glycolysis, but instead of simply reversing the reaction, 2 enzymes are used instead. First, pyruvate carboxylase converts pyruvate to oxaloacetate using ATP. And oxaloacetate is a molecule that may sound familiar to all of you biochemistry studs. Second, PEP carboxy kinase uses another high-energy phosphate bond from GTP to convert oxaloacetate to PEP. So why this very expensive song and dance, you might ask? One reason is that it's pretty limiting for pyruvate to be the only precursor for glucose, since only a handful of amino acids can be directly converted to pyruvate. The reason you've probably heard of oxaloacetate before is because it's also one of the Krebs cycle intermediates. And this intersection of pathways allows you to synthesize glucose with basically anything that enters the Krebs cycle, including a wider range of amino acids and even some of the free fatty acids, which is, all things considered, pretty nifty. The next several steps of gluconeogenesis are literally the reverse of the payoff phase of glycolysis. And while the payoff phase yields 2 ATP per 3 carbon sugar, the first steps of gluconeogenesis cost 2 ATP and 1 GTP per 3 carbon sugar. 1 ATP by pyruvate carboxylase, 1 GTP by PEP carboxy kinase, and a second ATP used by phosphoglycerate kinase in a reaction that is literally the reverse of the reaction performed in glycolysis. So by this point in gluconeogenesis, we've spent 3 high-energy phosphate bonds per 3-carbon sugar, for a total of 6 high-energy phosphate bonds. The second and third bypass reactions occurred during the reverse of the investment phase of glycolysis. Remember back during glycolysis when we needed ATP for the reactions catalyzed by hexokinase and PFK? Well, in theory, we could simply reverse the reactions and gain back some of the ATP after spending so much on reversing the payoff phase. But as it turns out, when you have your phosphorylated 6-carbon sugar that you need to remove the phosphates from, it's actually much faster to simply chop them off the molecule than it is to try to shift the phosphate back to ADP. And that means that you use a phosphatase instead of a kinase. So instead of PFK and hexokinase, gluconeogenesis employs fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase to remove the first phosphate, and glucose 6-phosphatase to remove the second phosphate. Sounds like a mouthful, but fortunately, the nomenclature is super intuitive. Fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase removes a phosphate from, fructose 1,6-bisphosphate to turn it into plain old fructose 6-phosphate. How do you know it's got to be the 1-phosphate that's removed first? Well, because your next enzyme is glucose 6-phosphatase, meaning that the first enzyme didn't get rid of the 6-phosphate yet. So think about it. What reaction does glucose 6-phosphatase catalyze? Well, using the same naming system as before, glucose-6-phosphatase must be responsible for cleaving a phosphate from glucose-6-phosphate to give you, you guessed it, regular old glucose, the end product of gluconeogenesis. Final review, because I know that was kind of a lot. What enzymes in glycolysis are not used in gluconeogenesis, and what enzymes are used in their place? Three of the four kinases in glycolysis, hexokinase, PFK, and pyruvate kinase, are not used in gluconeogenesis. Instead, pyruvate kinase is replaced with pyruvate carboxylase and PEP carboxykinase. PFK is replaced with fructose-1,6-bisphosphatase, and hexokinase is replaced with glucose-6-phosphatase. Unfortunately, these changes make gluconeogenesis a pretty expensive process. Glycolysis only produces 2 net ATP per glucose molecule, whereas gluconeogenesis costs 4 ATP and 2 GTP. But because glucose is so ubiquitously used as catabolic fuel and can be easily transported throughout the body, certain organs like the liver and kidneys specialize in harvesting the scraps of other molecules and turning them into the universally usable glucose, even at a net loss of energy. Part 3. How are gluconeogenesis and glycolysis regulated? As it turns out, there's another very important reason for gluconeogenesis to use different enzymes than glycolysis, and that's for the purpose of regulation. While gluconeogenesis is a net energy inefficient process, imagine how much more inefficient it would be for the same cell to attempt to perform glycolysis and gluconeogenesis at the same time. Basically, a very expensive way of getting nothing done. Fortunately, the gateway enzymes that initiate glycolysis and gluconeogenesis are different and can therefore be independently regulated, so that only one of the two is happening in a given cell at a given time. While all of the unique enzymes of gluconeogenesis are upregulated during the fasting state, and the unique enzymes of glycolysis are upregulated during the fed state, the enzymes we're going to focus on are the ones in the middle of the reaction, or the rate-limiting steps of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. Phosphofructokinase, or PFK, is the rate-limiting enzyme in glycolysis. Remind me again what reaction it catalyzes? Like a lot of enzymes, it's all in the name. It's a kinase, meaning it harnesses the energy from cleaving a high-energy phosphate bond and transfers that phosphate group to the reactant. And the reactant in this case is also in the name, phosphofructo, or a fructose molecule that's already been phosphorylated. To be more specific, PFK catalyzes the phosphorylation of fructose-6-phosphate to fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. We're going to call them F6P and F16BP, because I'm going to be saying those a lot. Now, I already mentioned that the kinase reactions are some of the most tightly regulated, because it ain't like ATP grows on trees. But if you can sort of conceptualize the glycolysis pathway, you'll realize that this is smack dab in the middle of a glycolysis reaction, which seems like a weird point to regulate glycolysis. Why not have the main point of regulation be right at the beginning of glycolysis, say, with hexokinase? Well, the answer is that while hexokinase begins the process of glycolysis by converting glucose into G6P, G6P can still do other stuff. What's one important fate of G6P besides glycolysis? Glycogen storage, right. But the next step regulated by PFK, or the conversion of F6P to F16BP, is the step that effectively commits glucose to completing glycolysis, and for that reason, it's not only rate-limiting, but also the most tightly regulated step. Okay, so we know glycolysis, and by that token PFK, is upregulated during the fed state. Chemically, PFK is allosterically activated when adenosine monophosphate and adenosine diphosphate binds to an inactive site on the enzyme itself. What this means is that when the cell's used up most of its ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, and all you have lying around is AMP and ADP, PFK activity increases in order to funnel glucose into the catabolic glycolysis pathway and replenish the stores of ATP. Pretty logical, right? Well, the reverse is true for the regulation of gluconeogenesis, and it turns out that gluconeogenesis is primarily regulated at approximately the same point in the reaction. Remind me again. If PFK catalyzes the phosphorylation of F6P to F16BP during glycolysis, what enzyme catalyzes the bypass reaction that effectively reverses the process during gluconeogenesis? Fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, or FBPase, dephosphorylates F16BP to F6P. The molecules adenosine mono and diphosphate that served as allosteric activators of PFK actually serve as allosteric inhibitors of FBPase, meaning that if the cell's used up most of its ATP, the metabolites AMP and ADP basically go, "Aw, hell no, you're not spending ATP we don't have building piles of expensive glucose," or something like that. But it illustrates another cool reason to have different enzymes for these bypass reactions, entirely apart from the fact that it's far easier to strip off a phosphate molecule than try to stick it back on the ATP. The fact that you have separate enzymes means that one enzyme can be turned on while the other one is turned off, so you don't have the cell trying to perform glycolysis and gluconeogenesis at the same time. But there's an additional nifty way that this enzyme is regulated. We know that since PFK is the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis, it's actually fairly common for substantial quantities of the reactant, F6P, to build up when glucose is abundant, since PFK can't convert it all to F16BP fast enough. And the reverse is true of FBPase for gluconeogenesis. But as it turns out, the PFK and FBPase we just discussed are only two types of enzymes capable of modifying phosphorylated fructose. Technically speaking, they're known as PFK1 and FBPase1, because they either add or remove a phosphate group to the one carbon of the fructose molecule. As it turns out, there's also a PFK2 that helps make fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, as well as an FBPase2 capable of removing the phosphate from the 2 carbon of fructose. You want to know something crazier? It's the same molecule. What? Mind blown. Literally, it's like somebody took a kinase and a phosphatase and mashed them together so that one end is kinase activity and the other end has phosphatase activity. But only one or the other is active at any given time, and you'll see why in a minute. For now, you might be thinking to yourself, okay, so what do you even do with fructose 2,6-bisphosphate? Can you eat it? Make glycogen with it? Tell me, Arjun, I am literally on the edge of my seat dying to know. Well, it's actually none of these. The sole purpose of F26BP is to serve as yet another allosteric activator of PFK1. And just to make sure you're still with me, does that mean that F26BP promotes glycolysis or gluconeogenesis? Glycolysis. And here's why that makes sense. See, there's usually a lot more PFK1 activity in the cell than PFK2. So most F6P gets sent down the glycolysis pathway via conversion to F16BP. But when glucose is abundant and PFK1 starts to act as a glycolysis bottleneck, enough F6P starts to accumulate to where a substantial amount of it also gets converted to F26BP. And here's where the magic happens. Since F26BP's job is to basically accelerate glycolysis by ramping up PFK1, it effectively serves as a way to unblock PFK1 when it's becoming a bottleneck to glycolysis. Not only that, it also suppresses gluconeogenesis by inhibiting FBPase1 to prevent the creation of more F6P when there's already a bottleneck. This is an example of feed-forward stimulation. When glucose is abundant during the fed state, glycolysis is accelerated and gluconeogenesis is suppressed. So a lot of the regulation of F26BP is simply based on the kinetics of the rate-limiting PFK1 enzyme. But the enzyme that creates it, namely PFK2, is itself subject to regulation. Since the purpose of F26BP is to stimulate glycolysis and suppress gluconeogenesis, it makes sense that some of the end products of glycolysis, such as ATP and citrate of the citric acid cycle fame, would feedback inhibit its synthesis by allosterically inhibiting PFK2. But the fasting state is where things get really fun. Because here's a lesson you've already learned. Wherever there's another enzyme, there's another opportunity for regulation. During the fasting state, the KAMP signaling cascade of glucagon indirectly causes the phosphorylation of the bifunctional enzyme, turning off the PFK2 activity and activating FBPase2. So you actually start breaking down the F26BP molecules that were responsible for promoting glycolysis and inhibiting gluconeogenesis in the first place. Furthermore, glucagon actually suppresses synthesis of the bifunctional PFK2-FBPase2 enzyme, which, remember, defaults to kinase activity and the creation of F26BP. All right, that's a lot of numbers and letters, so we're going to stop here for a couple of questions, just to make sure you got the basics. First, how does F26BP affect the rates of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis? F26BP is the most potent allosteric activator of glycolysis via the rate-limiting enzyme PFK1, and the most potent allosteric inhibitor of gluconeogenesis via the rate-limiting enzyme FBPase1. Second, how are the intracellular levels of F26BP themselves regulated? F26BP levels are determined by a single bifunctional enzyme with a PFK2 region that can synthesize it from the glycolysis reactant F6P and an FBPase2 region that essentially breaks it back down. At its most basic, the levels of F26BP increase during the fed state when glucose is replete, simply as a result of having excess of the reactant F6P. But the bifunctional enzyme can also be regulated allosterically or at the level of transcription. And the most important allosteric regulator is glucagon, which induces a shift from PFK2 to FBPase2 activity and decreases enzyme transcription. The end result is that during the fasting state, glucagon can suppress the levels of F26BP, thereby suppressing glycolysis and disinhibiting gluconeogenesis. And that's a wrap. Let's see what you learned about gluconeogenesis today, friends. First, can you define gluconeogenesis in terms of the starting reactants and the end products? Gluconeogenesis is the process of synthesizing glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors, i.e. non-glycogen. It takes place mostly in the liver and the kidneys. The major reactants that can enter the gluconeogenesis pathway are lactate, glycerol, propionate, and a handful of what are collectively referred to as glucogenic amino acids. Second, can you list the three unique enzymes used in gluconeogenesis? First, it's important to realize that as catalysts, enzymes are inherently bidirectional, and that most of the reactions in gluconeogenesis are simply the reverse of glycolysis reactions carried out with the same enzymes. That being said, three of the four kinases used in glycolysis are substituted for bypass steps that prioritize regulation and kinetic efficiency over energy yield. The final glycolysis step using pyruvate kinase is replaced with the conversion of pyruvate to oxaloacetate by pyruvate carboxylase, then the conversion of oxaloacetate to PEP by PEP carboxykinase. Of note, phosphoglycerate kinase is the only kinase used by both glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. The kinase steps in glycolysis catalyzed by hexokinase and phosphofructokinase are replaced with phosphatase steps that do not generate ATP. PFK1 is replaced by fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which catalyzes the conversion of F16BP to F6P, and hexokinase is replaced by glucose 6-phosphatase, which catalyzes the conversion of G6P to glucose. Third, can you name the rate-limiting enzymes of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, respectively? The rate-limiting steps of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis both involve the conversion between F6P and F16BP. The enzyme that catalyzes the forward reaction in glycolysis is phosphofructokinase 1, or PFK1, and the enzyme that catalyzes the reverse reaction in gluconeogenesis is fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, or FBPase1. It's important to note that the things that tend to activate PFK1 during the fed state also tend to inhibit FBPase1, and the opposite is true for the fasting state. Otherwise, you're left with an extremely energy-inefficient situation, where a cell is both trying to catabolize and synthesize glucose at the same time. Finally, can you describe how the levels of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, or F26BP, change during the fed and fasting states? And how do these levels affect glucose metabolism? F26BP is a carbohydrate, much like F16BP in the glycolysis pathway. But the primary function of F26BP in the cell is to potentiate glycolysis and inhibit gluconeogenesis. When glucose is replete during the fed state, reactants before the rate-limiting step accumulate, including F6P, which is the precursor molecule to F26BP. Reaction kinetics dictate that when more F6P accumulates, more F26BP will be generated. And the F26BP serves to allosterically activate the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis, diminishing the bottleneck. During the fasting state, glucagon signal cascade alters the activity of the bifunctional enzyme responsible for the conversion between F6P and F26BP via phosphorylation. Phosphorylating the enzyme changes its activity from PFK2 to FBPase2, decreasing the amount of F26BP in the cell and disinhibiting gluconeogenesis. Well done, gang. I know that was a tough one. But hey, armed with your newfound knowledge, you now get to explain hypoglycemia to your patient from the beginning of the episode. Here's a hint, though. You might have to simplify it a bit. A 52-year-old male presenting with symptoms of viral gastroenteritis is concerned that he may develop hypoglycemia after failing to tolerate food by mouth for 24 hours. Do you share his concern? And how do you plan to explain your thought process to your patient? Your patient tolerates a cup of water, but looks queasy when you hand him a sandwich. You acknowledge and empathize with your patient's concerns, but inform your patient that the human body has a number of important systems in place to ensure steady levels of glucose in the bloodstream at all times. Remembering that he works as a banker, you liken glucose to the basic currency that every cell in the body uses. Our first line of defense against hypoglycemia is the starch called glycogen, stored in our liver, muscles, and kidneys, you tell your patient. They're like a piggy bank full of glucose. And just like a piggy bank, they'll run out pretty quick without a steady income of food. But, you add, as your patient looks worried, as it turns out, your body actually also has a whole bunch of assets. Lactate, protein, stuff like that, that it can liquidate and turn into glucose. It's a process with a big fancy term called gluconeogenesis. And let's just say, most people have enough assets to keep the blood glucose level stable for many days. He chuckles, saying that he could probably stand to lose some of those assets before his next physical exam. What you can't go without, you say as you discharge him, is water. Water's water, and there ain't no liquidating that, because it's already liquid, you say, getting another chuckle out of him. So if you can't hold down water, even with the nausea pills, come straight back in, and we'll take care of you. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full Brix experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.